You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
Hey, hey, welcome to HR Bandit, the pod where we discuss the latest from the world of work. This is your host, Ankita, and I'm extremely excited about our show today. It's been a season of trends and catchphrases. So far, we've come across the great regret, quiet quitting, quiet firing, act your wage, moonlighting, the crying CEO, and more. If you've been following my blog or this pod, you probably know that I'm a big fan of catchphrases. I strongly believe there's no better way to capture attention and convert something mundane into a trend than coining a catchphrase for it. Naturally, it was hard for me to just pick three terms, but without further ado, let's jump straight into our topics for the day. First up, the Great Regret. Now, evidence says that the Great Resignation did not turn out to be the fairy tale employees were expecting to be. With the reality not matching expectations, regret levels are higher than expected. For our second topic, act your wage. Now, I prefer this to quiet quitting, but do I agree with everything that's being said? Not really. And for our last and final topic for the day, neurodiversity. Are you surprised at its inclusion? In keeping up with the trend of talking about inclusion and diversity in our episodes, there's no better topic than the one every organization is currently attempting to tackle. And Bandits, who better to discuss this with than our guest for today? I'm so pleased to introduce you to Dr. Ian Eyston. Ian currently retired from full-time corporate executive work after 30 years in business, with over 20 of them as HR director in four well-known organizations, Volkswagen Group UK, Skanska UK, Network Rail, and River and Mercantile Asset Management. He's a highly commercial ex-HR director with a broad range of skills, with a strong focus on pensions, diversity and inclusion, and recruitment. He is both a qualified accountant, FCMA, and chartered HRF professional, FCIPD, has an MBA, and most recently, a doctorate from Cranfield University. He's also an expert of neurodiversity, especially autism in his workplace, which was also the subject of his doctorate. Ian, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much. I am doing really well, and it is fabulous to be here with you today. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
I am really excited to speak to you, especially on like the range of topics. It's one of the best pods we've had so far. Okay. But before we jump into the three topics, I'm very curious to learn more about your doctorate journey and if you'd actually recommend anyone else to embark on it.
That's a really interesting question, and a very dangerous question, actually. So my journey, I guess it came in two parts. When I was doing one of my jobs as a HR director, I had two situations very quickly, one after the other, where I was asked to fire an employee. And in both cases, their managers had said that they were being insubordinate and disrespectful, and they needed to be sacked. And when I spoke to the two employees, in both cases, they were people who were on the autism spectrum. And they hadn't meant to upset their manager. It was just the way that they communicated. And I realized when I looked at it, it wasn't the employee's fault that there was a problem. And it actually wasn't the manager's fault, because we hadn't trained the managers to understand about this type of diversity, because, you know, it's a new form of diversity which people aren't aware of. And it was actually the organization's responsibility to deal with a situation. And I was just enrolling in my doctoral program at Cranfield, and I knew I wanted to do it on something to do with HR, but I hadn't chosen my final subject. And bringing kind of that practical experience together made me realize that that was such an important topic for HR teams and for organizations to think about, and that nobody was really thinking about it from an employment point of view. So that's what got me started. In terms of would I recommend it? At the end, yes, I definitely would. It's a fabulous feeling to have looked at something that's really important and given it the time to really, really deeply understand something. And I've met some fabulous people along the way, spoken to a lot of autistic and neurodiverse people and learned so much. But I guess if you'd asked me during the process, it's very deep and takes up a lot of time and can be a little bit frustrating. So you have to be patient. I did it part time rather than full time. So it actually took me 6 years. And
oh, wow.
It's quite a big chunk of time to be doing that. So I'm now glad it's finished, but I learned so much. So overall, the journey was definitely worth it.
I've heard so much about the blood, sweat and tears that come along during the dissertation journey.
Yes.
That I have contemplated it in the past, but it's always like, oh, I'm going to have to write a dissertation. Maybe not.
Yes, my dissertation ended up being over 500 pages and 100,000 words. So it was quite a monster.
Are you publishing it?
I'm in the process of trying to publish, first of all, an article, so a summary of it. So I'm talking to some of the big HR journals to see if I can get it published at the moment. So I'll keep you posted.
Oh, we'd love to read that. With that, I'm going to actually move us on to our first topic. We're talking about great regrets, but of course, the PhD journey is not a great regret. So I first came across this term on the HR Famous podcast. It is one of my favorite podcasts, and I go back there. So obviously, it caught my interest. And then a quick internet search later discovered a whole host of statistics and articles, mostly US-based. But they were focused on job switchers experiencing regret post-move. During the peak of Great Resignation, every month since June 2021, more than 4 million workers, or 3% of the total US employment, quit their jobs. Bandits, per usual, everything we discuss will be linked in the show notes below. So watch out for that space. But coming back to the stats, now it is natural that a percentage of quitters miss their old job. Like it's impossible that 100% of the people who quit are happy. However, per job search site Muse's study, of more than 2,500 US workers, almost three quarters, 72%, experienced either surprise or regret that their new position or new company quit their job for what turned out to be very different from what they were led to believe. Nearly half, about 48%, of these workers said they would try and get their old job back, thanks to a phenomena that Muse is calling shift shock, another catchphrase. They'll join a new company thinking it's their dream job, and then there's a reality check. The company's CEO, Catherine Minshew, told Fox Business. It's really damaging phenomena where people are brand new in their role and they suddenly realize it's not at all as advertised. Another survey by Harris Poll for USA Today, conducted in March 2022, found one in five workers who quit their job during the past 2 years regret it. Ian, have you come across this term yet?
I have come across the term, yes.
And how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm not so big into catchphrases, but as you said at the start, I understand why people use it because it's a great way to kind of encapsulate some ideas. But it doesn't at all surprise me that the stats show that people are quite often disappointed when they change jobs. I, as I said, and you said in my introduction, I've done a lot of recruitment during my HR career. And I'm amazed at how poor recruitment processes are from both sides of the equation. I see almost every company I've ever worked for and everyone I've advised starting off from a very poor position. Lots of people think they're good at recruitment when they're not. And therefore, I think organizations do a really bad job of selling themselves, of explaining what the job's like. And there's lots of mistakes that they make, which mean that they're not giving the candidates a good understanding of what they'll be getting into. So again, no surprise that when someone gets there, it's a bit different from what they're expecting. But the other big thing is, I actually find very many candidates are very poor at interviewing and doing their own recruitment. They don't approach it in a very, very systematic way. Lots of people, particularly if they're disenchanted with their current job, tend to kind of be very casual in a sense about how they go about recruitment, and they prioritize the wrong things when they are looking for a new job, they're so desperate to get away from what they've left that they tend to exaggerate the positives they see in an interview or a recruitment process and kind of take a blind eye to the things that they really should be focusing on. So when you've got companies doing a bad job of recruitment and candidates doing a bad job of recruitment, it's no surprise that it's not a very successful process. So I still do a bit of consultancy for an executive search firm, and I work very hard to make sure that both sides of the equation really approach it in a much more professional way than most people do.
And that's a very valid point. When I was thinking about it, I realized people have moved to accelerated hiring. So traditionally, we've said 7 rounds of interviews is way too much. Why are we having many conversations? And yes, organizations may feel it's a waste of time. Employees, like candidates, might feel like it's just way too long. But whenever I've given those many interviews, I've realized that you get to meet a wide variety of people. Mm-hmm. You get a better feel of what the organization is. Whereas when you're having a conversation with just two people, you're just like, I don't know the as much as I would like to have. But a lot of times it's like, great, like you've given 2 interviews, you've got the job in hand. So I wanted to ask you, like, are there, based on your experiences as a candidate, are there red flags that come up when I'm interviewing? Like, what are the typical red flags that a candidate should be very wary of? And what are, well, for lack of a better term, let's call them green flags. Like, what are the things they're like, this is it, this is the job I should take?
Yes. Yes. Well, I think there are. And I think there are things that candidates can do to improve their chances of spotting the red flags and also spotting the green flags. I think one of the big mistakes that both candidates and companies make is that too much of the recruitment process tends to focus on the technical aspect of a job, what someone will be doing. And what I think gets missed, and I think particularly to your point, that the fewer people you meet, the more likely it's to get missed, is that actually what someone, I think, enjoys about a job is much more than just what they're doing. I think it's really important about who their manager is, who their colleagues are, what the culture of the organization is, what the philosophy of the organization is, how does an organization act in terms of, is it honorable, is it ethical, is it environmentally orientated, where is it going? Do they have any big decisions coming? And quite often people get so focused on, will I be using that bit of IT system or that bit of IT system, in a very technical assessment? And there are so many other factors. So I think for me, some really great questions, if you ask whoever you're interviewing about things beyond the initial part of the job. So what's the culture of the organization like? How do people get remunerated, not just in terms of the basic package, but is something to do with how the whole firm performs, involved in how you get paid? And ask questions like, how do people socialize and things like that, particularly in a kind of post-pandemic, post-working from home environment. People might have very different expectations and hopes in terms of how much interaction they're going to have with people, particularly of different generations, which I'm seeing a lot of at the moment. The under 35s have a very different view of the workplace to the over 45s currently. So there's some real potential red flags there. And the other thing you can do is, these days, you can make technology your friend. You can find out things about the company, about the job, not just from the interview process. So, something like Glassdoor, where you can go on websites and see what current and ex-employees have said about certain jobs and certain companies, can be really, really valuable, particularly if you look at that before you interview. And if there's things that look like they might be starting to be red flags, take those as questions and put them into the interviewer and ask them, I see somebody left your company because they were unhappy with X. So tell me, why did that happen?
I love that. I'm going to try make some comments here and then tie it into our second topic, because a lot of times people left was compensation, right? Mm-hmm. And there were companies out there that were paying much more than your current organization. And then there was, of course, this whole thing of flexibility that was offered, like you can work from anywhere. And these two things, once they draw you in, the thing is, okay, now I get 2x of what I used to get paid. My previous organization isn't going to pay me that. And it's very likely that the other organizations there pay me as much. So you're kind of stuck. And then I was thinking about this whole trend of quiet quitting. We'll debate whether I like the term or not in a bit. But there was this whole concept of I don't get paid as much as I am asked to do. I don't get recognized or valued for it, right? Now, of course, quiet quitting has got a whole backlash because of the wording of the term, and it's gotten transformed into act your wage. But I'm very curious, like when you first heard this term, what was your reaction?
That's a really good question. It's quite interesting. I think I almost, when I first heard it, I think I probably misunderstood how people were using it. I kind of took the angle, because I think certainly some of the UK media portrayed it as a section of people that were unhappy about something to do with their current job, quite often unhappy again about some of the things I just talked about in terms of maybe the cultural aspects. You know, I don't like my manager, I don't like what we're doing. But rather than kind of fight to try and change it and to sort of make improvements within, I think my interpretation was people were saying, this is just too hard work. I'm just going to quietly disappear. If they want to be like that, be like that. I'm going to go somewhere to where I'm happier. And I think then, as you say, it's probably, you know, if you get attracted to something that pays more, up front, that looks attractive. But it's a really difficult one, because I've seen people leave organizations that I've been working for where they've been offered such an increase. They've kind of come to me and said, I love this job, but I just feel like I have to go to what I've been offered, because I know you can't match what they've offered me. But it's just life changing in terms of it means I can get a bigger mortgage and a bigger house. So they already know that it's a red flag. They know, part of them screaming at themselves to say this is going to be a problem, but they just kind of feel tempted and they go for it. And then, of course, you know, the other things that really matter to people kick in, and they realize that whilst pay might be a important factor, for most people it's not the only important factor. And if you don't have the flexibility you want, or if you get less appreciated, quite often you get paid more, but they assume that they don't need to appreciate you and give you the verbal comments and the compliments, because we're paying you a heap load of money. You just, you know, that's their way of saying we like you. Whereas actually some people, what they really realize after they've moved is, although the money's nice, they preferred having a boss that was so supportive and complimentary that they felt good about themselves. So they get more money, but they feel less good about themselves. So that's a real dilemma for a lot of people. And I think the big message, and again, you know, I do coach people in terms of thinking about changing jobs, is really understand yourself. You know, so I would kind of convert act your wage to something like understand your values, understand what matters to you, because it's not the wage that matters the most to many people. There are so many other factors that matter to people. So you've got to understand what your priorities are really before you act it. And don't just act your wage, act who you really are, which might be not the money, it might be something else.
There's so much to unpack in what you just said. Like, first of all, it's right. Getting paid almost double is potentially a red flag, because if the job was great, did they really have to pay you that much? Or are they just, you know, paying you so much that you would just like not ask any more questions and switch? But then there's also, like, you're so right, because when you were saying what first went through your mind when you heard the phrase quiet quitting, I think it's phrased in a way that people first think of the negative, because yeah, they're like, there has to be something wrong when someone's quiet quitting. Whereas had the first time this concept been socialized and was socialized as act your wage, people would have thought, well, it may have some negative connotation again because the way it's done, but it wouldn't have had like the whole reaction we've had from a lot of leaders from around the world saying quiet quitting is terrible, you should never do it. Like, then you would say, you can't really say act your wage is terrible and you mustn't do it, right? Because then that's just like, what exactly are we saying here?
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
my other question on this, like, do you think this is a trend that needs discussing, or is it just another TikTok trend that's done its time and, you know, we move on?
No, I think it is something that's really important to discuss. I think we're at a very interesting kind of tipping point in terms of society at the moment. There's all sorts of uncertainties in the world. We seem to have had a whole combination of things that have come at us all at once. The pandemic and the lockdowns kind of fractured the sort of globalization path we were on. And there's a question mark about whether we go back in that direction or whether we end up being a bit more isolated as countries and societies. You've got, the invasion of Ukraine, which has impacted on supply chains and food production and made inflation and other things problematic that people weren't thinking about. And it's made some goods and services and therefore some industries have a different kind of perception to what they had before. And then you've got kind of a combination of all of that and economic uncertainty. You've got people thinking, well, what really matters to me? You know, it's kind of, you know, those last 2 or 3 years, people have had probably more time on their own, more time to think about what they care about. And, you know, I think the quiet quitting, you know, the positive aspect of it is actually people saying, let's not just keep doing what I was doing because that's just what I was doing. But let's think about what really matters to me. And I don't need to be loud about it because other people might have different perspectives. But what matters to me deep down, it might be money. That might be the big priority. You might be at that point in your life where that's what's most important. Then that's fine. Find the person that's going to play you more. And if you don't mind doing what they want you to do, then you're happy. But for other people, and I've definitely seen it, my kids are all in their 20s and they're all kind of starting their careers and they're all in different industries talking to different friends. And I get a very different sense talking to them about their colleagues. They've got very different priorities from what older generations have currently got. And some of the things you talked about before in terms of really flexibility matters a lot and actually being appreciated and being able to do the kind of work they want to do really matters to them. And I certainly in my pensions world, I know a lot of people are getting very focused on the environment and the important decisions we need to make about the future of the world. And lots of people want to work in a job and in a career that is in some way contributing to making the world better. And actually, that might not be the best paid job, but for them, that's really significant. So again, it might be a quiet quit. It might be acting their wage. It might be acting their priorities, acting their gut instinct that what's going to make them happy. And I think, therefore, I would encourage people actually to be thinking about this a lot. I don't think it's just a trend. I actually would, going back to what I said right at the start, I think historically people haven't thought enough about how they changed jobs and what their priorities were. And I think people thinking about it more now is really important and hopefully really beneficial.
It also makes sense, right? Like quiet quitting is maybe smart that you stay quiet while you're hunting for your next job.
Yeah, of course. Well, so I think also just very quickly to finish on that, mm-hmm. I think sometimes people who you work with and particularly, you know, your bosses, they have a perception of you. And actually, that's just their perception. And they might not really know you. And they might be surprised by some of the things that you decide are your priorities. So actually, you could confuse them if you're in one job and you say, well, actually, what I'm going to do next is something totally different. They think, where did that come from?
Actually, you made me think, like, is it that quiet quitting always existed and it's now become a discussion? Because like earlier, you could pretend to be really working while not working, by just pretending to be busy while in the office. And when you're not there, you're only judged by the outcomes. And then someone's like, is this person quiet quitting because I don't see them being as busy?
That might be possible. I think the other thing that I think is a trend that's kind of layered in with this, which is subtle but quite important, is I think that there are genuinely, historically, been some negative aspects of work and culture that people have had to put up with and they're not prepared to put up with them anymore. And whether that be things like gender or racial discrimination, or just hierarchical bossy bosses, whatever it is, I think historically people have felt almost compelled to accept what that was until they left. And yeah, probably, you know, when they left, they maybe kept quiet why they left, because they didn't necessarily want to cause a fuss and say, well, actually, part of the reason I'm going because my boss was horrible to me. I think perhaps people are more prepared to do that. I think that, you know, whether it be the Me Too campaign or other things that have happened, I think groups of people have got more of a voice and are prepared to perhaps say a bit more about some of the reasons why they are leaving. So we might find that we go from quiet quitting to very noisy quitting in the future, as people actually, and I think we've had a couple of examples, you know, not to name individual organizations, but I can think of a couple, particularly in the US, where people have very, very publicly left over the last 12 months and said why they've left. And it's the exact opposite of a quiet quitting. It's been a very, very noisy quit.
Without doubt, I think we are moving into a space, and I love that, where we are no longer tolerating toxicity in the workplace and we are calling it out. With that, I'm going to switch to our last topic, because I do want to spend longer here than all the others, because in my opinion, like, the great regret is fine, quiet quitting is fine, but neurodiversity is something that I watched a lot of organizations want to tackle and then confess that they're not really getting very far in this space. I wanted to ask, like, in your work, did you discover organizations that are ahead in the space? Is there something that we could learn from them?
Yeah, there are some organizations that have been thinking about this longer than others, earlier than others, and been making some giant leaps forward. And I don't think anybody's cracked it. Even organizations that have been thinking about it would admit that they still got things to do, but compared to, you know, other types of diversity which we've been working on for decades, this is a much newer area, and there's still a lot to learn. I mean, yeah, it's really dangerous now, because, as I say, I've spent the last 6 years thinking about this topic, so you could get me talking for the next 6 hours on this one. But if I try and kind of give you a few kind of headlines, the big thing about neurodiversity to start with is, unlike most of the other kinds of diversity, it's quite often hidden. It's not visible, at least initially, when you meet someone. So people don't necessarily see it. They don't necessarily understand it. They've probably not had the same levels of training and education at work. Line managers certainly don't know how to handle it. And also, a big thing about neurodiversity that I've learned, which was a very, very powerful lesson, is that there's a huge amount of diversity within neurodiversity. So even if you've dealt with someone that is neurodiverse or neurodivergent, if you then apply that same technique to other people, you'll still get it wrong. So you have to be, as an individual in an organization, if you want to handle neurodiversity well, you have to be so mentally agile, you have to be so open-minded, and so prepared to ask lots of great questions to understand what it is that someone needs so that they can give their best at work. Otherwise, you find that you either just don't recruit them in the first place because you don't understand them, or when you do recruit them, it just becomes a really unsatisfactory relationship because you're not getting the best out of them and they get frustrated. So there's so much that most organizations can learn from those that are starting to do it well.
I know I recently came across a survey where they went around and asked people to obviously mark them on the spectrum of, you know, neurodiversity. And a lot of people, like, forget about managers and organizations knowing that there is a spectrum. I think individuals sometimes don't get assessed, like, they don't know where they lie on the spectrum. So before we get into, like, what organizations can do you want to take, like, a minute to explain to our listeners what neurodiversity is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And actually, it's a really hard question to answer, because to date, there is no one fixed, accepted definition. But within the people that are talking about it, there's a kind of broad consensus that what we're talking about is basically the way that, for certain people, neurologically, the way their brain works in a very fundamentally different way from what we would call a neurotypical brain. And that can be expressed in a number of what we call conditions, which is not an elegant phrase, but people will have heard about autism or Asperger's or autism spectrum. They might have heard of ADHD, perhaps dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia. That there are a few others, but the point is that for the people that experience these conditions, that for certain aspects of how they operate, their brain works in a fundamentally different way. So, you know, a relatively straightforward one, people broadly understand that dyslexia is about words and how people look at written documents and translate written documents in a completely different way from a neurotypical way. They might struggle with certain fonts, with certain text sizes, with certain colours, with certain organisations of words on a page. So if you're a recruiter and you're putting a job ad out, or your website is not designed in a neurodiverse friendly way, you can put off dyslexic people who actually physically cannot read your websites. Autistic people can have really challenging difficulties around ways of communicating. Quite often they find kind of normal communication very difficult. They interpret what you say and what you do very literally, or they might not be able to understand nuances or idioms or metaphors, so they can misunderstand things. They don't necessarily understand typical working practices in the office. So you have to work very hard to understand them and for you to be able to communicate with them. And each of the different neurodiverse kind of conditions has its own challenges. So as I say, part of the thing is to recognize that there are people that have got neurological patterns in their brain that work in a different way to the neurotypical way of working. And it is a fundamental difference. And it's not just trivial or kind of minor. It is lifelong and significant.
Absolutely. Because I remember I went to this workshop and then they had an entire session on just web accessibility. Mm-hmm. Now there are protocols and what fonts you can use, what colors to use, because different fonts and triggers might trigger different people, font sizes, and just how code is written so that you can translate text to speech more easily and so on. But all of that aside, I also remembered a conversation I was present at, and it was really disturbing for me, which is why I'm going to run it by you. You can tell me if it is... If it's a thought you've seen prevalent and what we can do to combat it, right? Now, we were in a room talking about inclusion and diversity and all things nice. When someone stood up and said, oh, we had someone who went through a recent gender transformation. And when they came back to work, they sent out a detailed email on how they would like to be addressed, their experience, and just the fact that it's okay to get it wrong. I'm happy to be there to answer questions. And they were basically saying anyone who's different, including, say if someone's on autism spectrum, it makes it so much easier for us when they send out an email, tell us what to do. So they were just so scared of getting it wrong and were putting the responsibility of education on the other person. Now, I was infuriated because I think an individual already has to go through so much, and it is not their prerogative to educate. But am I right in feeling this way?
I can give you a long answer and a short answer, and I might do both. The short answer is, if I was to recruit you into my company and I said to you, Ankita, you're a woman and I don't understand women, can you explain to me how women need to be treated? Would you think that was acceptable? If I said to you, you're Indian and I've never worked with an Indian person, just explain to me briefly what I need to do to be culturally aware of Indian people, is that okay? Would you feel that? Would you feel comfortable with me as an employer?
Well, Ian, let me tell you this. You explained it better than I could have explained it to that group.
So that's the short answer. I think when you think of it in that context, it becomes really obvious it shouldn't be the individual's responsibility. Because, well, for a whole bunch of reasons, but Just going back to what you said previously, first off, diagnosis of neurodiverse conditions globally is very poor and very patchy, and in some places non-existent. So there are many people who are neurodivergent, have some of those conditions, who have never been diagnosed. So first and foremost, that's a challenge. Secondly, because many people get discriminated against, often starting right the way into education before they even get into employment, the stats show that only about one third of people who are neurodivergent actually disclose at work because they feel so uncomfortable. So if you go around saying to your employees, if you happen to be neurodivergent or any other difference that we don't happen to be able to read from your CV, can you tell us about it and explain to us what we need to do? If only a third have disclosed so far, the other two thirds are already thinking, oh my God, this organization does not really, really understand me. And they're not trying to help. They're just putting all the onus on me. That's very dangerous. And people find it very difficult to necessarily explain because, again, making it sound really stupid, but because you are something doesn't mean you can necessarily explain to somebody who isn't how they would interpret you. So, again, you know, I go back to my first answer, Anita and Ankita, you're a woman, I'm a man. Tell me how I should be. Tell me how I should deal with you. I mean, and explain it to me so that as a man, I will understand it. Well, how will you? How will you know how I'm going to understand it as a man? I mean, it's just crazy. But that's what we're saying if we ask people who are neurodiverse to explain it to them, because they will tell you that is the way I am, but it doesn't mean they will understand it the way you understand it. So I encourage organizations to think about it much more as their responsibility. Use third-party organizations to help. There are many fabulous charities, social enterprises, and other organizations that are there to assist organizations with that process. And often what they do is they provide service both to the individual and the employer so that they can understand each other, which is fabulous. Also, if you happen to have anybody in the organization who has happened to voluntarily disclose, like your example where that person had been through the gender reassignment and explained it, then that is a fabulous opportunity, because if they're prepared to talk about it, then it starts to make others feel comfortable. But perhaps you can also create a staff affinity group or a working group where you can say to people, if you want to be with like-minded people, not necessarily disclose to those of us that don't understand you, but want to start sharing your experiences amongst like-minded people, start there. We will encourage you and support you. And maybe you can retain your confidentiality, but as a group, bring some messages to us as an organization to say, we would love you to do these three things better for us as a group. And that way they can feel a collective responsibility. So there are many things you can do. And you talked about, you know, the dyslexic thing and making web accessibility great. Microsoft is a fabulous example of what you talked about. I mean, obviously, they're a technology company, so it's in their own commercial interest. But they really get neurodiversity. They've been going for a number of years, and they recruit for some jobs specifically neurodiverse people, and then they design their recruitment processes to make it friendly, but they also encourage anybody that is neurodiverse within the organization that they've recruited to talk about their processes, welcome other people into the business, and actually act as ambassadors for them. So there are so many things that you can do as an organization. And we're just on that tipping point of people needing to recognize there's a lot more that they can do.
I love that. I was about to ask you for like three things that you think every organization can do right now, and you've already listed more. So let's like, before we close this topic and as we move to our closing, are there three things as an individual, we have seen it from an employee, but say your advice for me, like three things I can do, our listeners can do today to be more inclusive in this space?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first and foremost, if you're really interested in being more inclusive in this area, do your research, do your homework. There are a growing number of websites, books, podcasts, all sorts of things that where people who are neurodiverse talk about their experiences and give firsthand experience of what it feels like from their side of the equation and what they'd love to see their colleagues do with them and for them. So I think when you kind of can walk in someone's shoe and listen to how they want to be treated, then that's a great starting point. I think the second thing is people, and it's the same when we started to think about gender diversity and racial diversity and LGBTQ, I think start to think about your language very carefully. People can be very sloppy, very careless, very, in a sense, uncaring by using language that's not thoughtful. So, you know, if you are starting to recognize that there might be people that have differences that you don't understand, well, yeah, of course, people can make mistakes, but don't knowingly keep using phraseology or saying things that might be unhelpful. And I think, I suppose the third thing is, once you do get in a situation where you are, you know, recruiting or managing or just being a team member, someone that's neurodiverse, and like with all diversity, work out what would make you a good ally. How can you use your voice to perhaps convert other people to understand it? How can you, if you've got an opportunity in your role to tweak the recruitment process or tweak the website or to tweak any kind of communication the firm's doing so that it becomes more neurodiverse friendly, then you are leveraging your understanding to benefit a wider part of the community and other people. So don't just do what you can do, but think how you can influence others.
Thanks, Ian. That's, I think, really useful, because I think I realize like how early I am in my own journey. Like I can guarantee I've made a fair amount of mistakes during this pod. But like it is a journey, and I think it's one that everyone should embark on. But with that, I'm going to try and close on a slightly different note. We've talked about dissertations. We've talked about a lot of serious things. Now, if you had to do your PhD or doctorate all over again, and you had to pick a topic that was not related to HR, what would you pick?
Oh, wow. What a great question. Well, I've got a very curious mind, and I've got a very broad range of interests. So I could probably answer that in a few different ways, and probably on different days, I'd give you a different answer. But my answer today would be, I am fascinated by our solar system. So I think I would do it on our solar system. And I think I would deeply want to understand more about the moon. And the fact that we're about to send people to the moon again over the next couple of years, and what might they face? And the fact that we've now got machines digging on the surface of Mars, and we're even thinking about potentially sending someone to Mars. And I'm really fascinated. And I think of myself as quite a smart person, but there's something about our solar system I've never understood. This concept of comets, you know how comets come into our solar system, go around the sun and then go away, and they go away for years and years and years and years, and then they turn around somewhere and they come back again. and like, how do they do that? And how do they end up? Like, I remember when I was a kid, I think it was something like 1976, the very famous Halley's Comet came, yeah. Which is, it has a 76-year cycle. And every 76 years through human history, it comes to Earth. So that means it spends about 40 years traveling away from us and then 40 years coming back. How does that work? That would be my next PhD if I had to do one. I find that fascinating.
I love that. I actually recently discovered some facts about Mercury, because I don't know, like, I know very little about our solar system except what we were taught in early days in school, but I had no idea Mercury didn't rotate on its axis. That was always like half of it is hot and then half of it is ice.
Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt. The other really curious thing about Mercury, I think it's Mercury. Is it Mercury or Venus? One of the two, the year is shorter than the day. Because
I don't know. I would guess it's Mercury because it's the closest.
Yes. Because it's a really strange concept. And again, your brain can't work it, but it takes longer for it to rotate on its axis than it does for it to go around the sun. So if we measure going around the sun as a year and going on its axis as a day, its year is shorter than its day. How weird is that?
Okay, I'll need time to go away and process this, Ian, but I have to get us out of here. Thank you so much. Like, we should come back and do an entire pod on the solar system.
Great.
At some point. But thank you so much for being here. Any closing words?
Well, thank you again for inviting me. Some really interesting topics, really interesting time. Obviously, as you know, because I've done my doctorate, I'm passionate about neurodiversity. So if you or any of your listeners want to know more, I'm very happy for you to follow me up offline. And if you want to talk about it again in the future, I'm very happy to tell you more, because there is so much more. It is just such an important subject.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ian. I will take you up on that offer. But for now, on behalf of Ian, myself, and NHRDN, we are out.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.